Dr. Mings, I really need to talk to you.
Emily. Yeah. I just got your message. I'm with my wife.
I went to your office, but you weren't there. So I came here and, can we just go talk?
If it's an emergency, I can admit you.
No. I just, I was getting on the subway and... And it was like when I was in the car. I have to go to work. I just need 5 minutes.
Hello, and welcome to The Collision, Collider's podcast about movies, TV, and more. I'm the site's managing editor, Matt Goldberg, and with me, as always, are associate editors Adam Chitwood.
Howdy.
And Dave Trumbore.
Hello.
Today we will be talking about Steven Soderbergh and his new film, Side Effects. We wanted to talk about Soderbergh because not only has he had a long career, but because he says he is retiring, and Side Effects is his last theatrical release, and his penultimate film, his quote-unquote last movie, will be Behind the Candelabra, but that will air on HBO. And that's a biopic about Liberace, starring Michael Douglas and Matt Damon. And I look forward to that, but I feel like Side Effects is definitely an end that we can talk about in a way, because just the theatrical distribution, more people will have a chance to see Side Effects, although judging by the box office, they wanted to see Melissa McCarthy and Jason Bateman have a wacky road trip and learn to get along. Blah.
God, I hate Fall Down.
Yeah. Jesus. Thanks a lot, Rex Reed.
Seriously.
Really sensitive of you. All right. I didn't know he was a shoplifter. I didn't know that. I was reading an article on Salon, and it's like, he also shoplifted back in the 70s. And
I didn't know that. I just thought he was a piece of shit.
He is a piece of shit. I'm just saying that's another shitty thing he did that was unrelated to being a bad critic. Yeah. What were we talking about? Oh, right, Steven Soderbergh. One of the things I really admire most about Steven Soderbergh is that he has always done his own thing. Even in the later part of his career, where it's really been one for you, one for me, he's still applying his own style to it. And it's a style that never feels overbearing. It's not like, oh, that's a Steven Soderbergh film. Like, it's a little hard to pin down. I would say there are certain markers, like his movies jump around in time. There's sort of a non-linear storytelling aspect to it. And there's a heavy influence of 60s European film. But even that doesn't feel like aggressive. It's not like Steven Soderbergh is trying to ape that style, and he's not doing it all the time. Traffic does not have that style, and it's a fairly straightforward film. Aaron Brockovich is almost unrecognizable as a Steven Soderbergh film. That film is so straightforward that you almost forget that Soderbergh directed it, and it simply becomes the movie that won Julia Roberts an Oscar. That's that movie. So, and that came out the same year as Traffic, which is clearly a Soderbergh film, but again, not by his same rules.
And
so,
amazingly, he was nominated for Best Director for both movies. And
exactly.
Both movies were nominated for Best Picture. And they're so completely different. I think that's one of the reasons why, like, you don't see people nominated twice in 1 year. And I think it's because Soderbergh is able to go into those different genres so well and just do his own thing. It's not that, like you said, it's not like he's taking, like, aping someone else's style. It's that he's doing his own thing, but not with, like, a pretentiousness that he's like, I'm going to do what I want. He's just like, oh, you know what would be cool if we do this? And it's just, like, out-of-the-box thinking that, I mean, sometimes works, sometimes doesn't, but most of the time it's great.
Right, but and there's a thoughtfulness to it. That's the other thing. It's usually not, I'm going to do this because it looks cool. It's going to be interesting, and you will get caught up in it. But, for instance, when I make Ocean's 12, and I want to talk a little bit more about that film a little later, but when I make Ocean's 12, I'm going to give it a completely different feel than Ocean's 11 because I've changed the setting, and I'm trying to give it not just be a retread of what I've done before. And I think that was off-putting to a lot of people, but I would encourage them to go back to Ocean's 12. I want to talk, again, more about that in terms of his expectations and what have been considered successes in his career and what have been the flops. But, again, going back to his style, I find it very refreshing, and not just in regards of artistically, but also as a distributor. He has been very much a true indie filmmaker in the sense of he's not been – it never feels like he was swallowed by the Hollywood system. it always feels like he has always had enough freedom to say, you know what, I'm going to go off and do my own thing on the cheap, and I'm going to release it the way I want to release it. So these days, VOD is very common for indie films. It's almost the guaranteed pathway. He did it in 2005 with Bubble. Back then, it was like, people were like, you're intentionally releasing this film to on demand, and you directed Ocean's 11. What the fuck are you doing? And Bubble is, like, I've never even seen Bubble, but from what I know about it, it is clearly not something that could have ever been released theatrically. It's only 73 minutes. But
yeah, it's non-professional actors.
Right, and it's improv. But even that notion that he could release a film that way, he was doing that long before anyone else wanted to. And he's done more films like that, like The Girlfriend Experience, where he cast a porn star in the lead role, even though it's not a pornographic film or anything like that. But he's sort of playing by his own rules, but then he's like, and now I'll do a film with Matt Damon. It's sort of a offbeat comedy, that sort of notion. But again, he does sort of, when he does his mainstream stuff, he still kind of goes into the 60s, but not always. And so, like, last year alone, we saw Haywire, which kind of has the vibe to it. But then you see Magic Mike, which feels modern.
Yeah, Haywire feels much more like an international movie, almost like a foreign film. And it was very off-putting for audiences. I remember seeing it in the theater, and a lot of people walked out.
And fuck those people, because that movie is great.
Seriously. Oh, yeah, it's a fantastic movie, because it's so different from everything else. The action scenes don't have, like, this pulse-pounding score. There's this really great score by I can't remember who does most of his movies. He did the Ocean's movies, but he did that. But it drops out for all the fight scenes. So the fight scenes are essentially silent, and everyone's like, what the fuck's going on? And they're very quick, and like a lot of people die. It was just it's a different movie, and like, why put out the same whatever action movie with, you know, input Sylvester Stallone here when you can do something completely different that people haven't seen before?
I don't like things I haven't seen before. It makes me uncomfortable with this.
Well, that's a good time for me to jump in and say that Soderbergh is one of those directors that I admire and I appreciate his work. He just doesn't make the films that I'm going to go out of my way to go see, with the exception of like Ocean's 11 and Traffic. That's about it. Like, I've seen more of his films, but I don't really like, they're not high replay value for me. Just because he has a new one coming out in theaters, I'm not excited to see it just based on that. It's just I like his work. He's great at what he does, and all the points that you guys made were valid. It's just, for me, just not one of my favorite directors out there.
Is there?
But I have to check out Haywire. I do have to see that.
You haven't seen it? I think you would like Haywire. I think Haywire is – I think you have enough of an open mind to sort of appreciate the genre aspects, but also see how he's willing to twist them. Because like Adam was saying, it's not just plug-in action star. He's trying to
– right.
Soderbergh is trying to give audiences something different that they can't really get anywhere else. You're getting a strong female lead who is not playing by the traditional rules. Like, usually one of the things that really annoys me in action films, and this has been happening for decades, it's that if there is a female hero who knows how to fight, she can only fight another woman, because the notion of her getting beat up upon by a man is distasteful, even though if she matches him punch for punch, then it still won't go that way. So I will say, like, and this may seem a bit of a leap, one of the moments I didn't like in the Fast and the Furious 6 trailer is when you see, I think it's Gina Carano, I think, fighting either Jordana Brewster or Michelle Rodriguez, or maybe it's Elsa Pataky. Pate maybe as well.
I think it's Michelle Rodriguez.
Yeah, and I will be willing to bet that that's the only scene with a woman fight. Like, that's the only scene, like the throwdown scene, because there's no scene where a guy is fighting a girl. Like, you just won't see it. And that's all Haywire is. There is no female antagonist for her. She only fights men, and she's amazing at it. And the film, like, literally does not pull punches. The fight between her and Michael Fassbender's character is brutal. And it's supposed to be brutal. And it's not in a sort of a fetishistic way, although there is a sexual aspect to it. That's one of the things I like the most about Haywire, is that it's not just a good action film, but it's really trying to go for these ideas of what makes a female action protagonist. How do we see a female action star? Do we see her sexually? Can we see her as just a fighter? How do you flip the script? And that's, one of the things I always like about Soderbergh is that he's trying to approach a film in a completely new direction. You take a film like Contagion, which could have been a general sort of disaster movie thriller, and he completely changes it around to sort of put you in there in a sense that doesn't feel overbearing, but does sort of create that dread in a way that feels realistic.
Yeah, I feel like Contagion is a masterwork of filmmaking. Just like every single thing that he does is calculated to make you feel like you are in that situation and you are feeling like what these people are going through. And I know he said, like, when he sat down with Scott Z. Burns to do the script, they had like a list of like no's and don'ts and stuff they weren't going to do that were in a bunch of other movies like that. Like, we're not going to show a city that our characters haven't been to, like a wide shot of the city. We're not going to show people dying that aren't our characters or people that we don't know. And it's just a different way of approaching it and just the way that he does it. You walk out of there wanting to look for like a hand sanitizer.
Yeah. I mean, I didn't walk out going that. I went into Contagion being like, yeah, if a pandemic happened, I'd probably die. I just went in with that acceptance, not because I know there are some people who go into Contagion and they're like germaphobes, and that film would just destroy them. It's out. They would go watch Outbreak and be like, "Oh, this is so calming. Oh, give me more Ebola virus. This is just let me wrap it around me like a blanket in this conventional movie making." Whereas Soderbergh is like, "What's happening on day 172? We're still fucked."
See, but that's why, in like Contagion and Outbreak, is a great example of the movies I like and the movies that I don't seek out. Like, I saw Contagion, fine, but I prefer Outbreak because when I go to see a movie, I don't want a fucking 2-hour CNN story, which is what I got today with Side Effects. I don't want that. I can see that anytime. I want an escapism. I want some. I
really,
want
you watch CNN and don't get a sense of escapism? Because I usually
well anymore. Yeah, Jesus Christ. But no, I don't. Yes, again, I appreciate his artistic approach to things and the level of detail that he has for all of his films and the steps that he's willing to take to sort of push the envelope. I respect that. He just doesn't make the films that I want to see. I will watch Outbreak 10 times for every one Contagion.
So Outbreak is like, find that monkey, Cuba Gooding Jr. You can do it.
Exactly. I will watch that all day. Thank you, Mrs. Paninini.
I like Outbreak a lot, but I think Contagion's really entertaining. Like, I wrapped up in it and I felt it, but I mean, you're following these characters and you're like finding out what's going on. And I thought it was interesting to show it's almost the traffic approach of seeing how this affects a bunch of different people at the same point in time. I just thought that was fascinating. I mean, I was entertained. I felt like I talked to other people that really enjoyed it. And I liked his approach of just grabbing just a ton of actors, like famous actors, and just putting them in the movie.
He's got great casts.
Yeah. A few minutes at a time. I thought that was really cool because you see all these like famous people that would lead their own movies die in like 10 minutes.
I really wish they hadn't spoiled the Gwyneth Paltrow thing in the trailers. That pissed me off.
That would have been crazy.
That would if you went in and not known that she just fucking perishes. And I don't feel bad spoiling it because the trailers did that.
Already did it, yeah.
So, although, Dave, after hearing what you said, I wish I could force you to sit down and watch Schizopolis, which is one of Soderbergh's earliest films. He had this interesting period where after Sex, Lies, and Videotape, he got a lot of attention. That was a breakthrough film. I played at Sundance. That was sort of during the rise of Sundance as an indie market. And then he went off and did these films that didn't really connect with anyone and sort of – and he's also going through a lot of personal stuff at the time. I think his wife divorced him. And he really turns inwards, but he still gets good films out of that. I still need to watch King of the Hill, but Schizopolis, God, I remember watching that film in high school and just like, oh my God, what's going on? And then I revisited it in college. And once you have the cadence of it down, like, it works really well. It's an indescribable film. It really is. But it's a film that is a great deep cut from his filmography. And then he sort of brings it back. He sort of finds his way back to, I guess, the mainstream with Out of Sight. Out of Sight sort of is a turning point in his career.
Yeah, my introduction to him was Brockovich, and then I saw Traffic and Ocean's 11. They were back-to-back, and I loved them. And then one of his next ones was Solaris, a Stanislav Lem adaptation. And I had just read that in like a sci-fi class in college. So I was really looking forward to it, and I was way disappointed by that.
Did you see the original?
the original? No, I don't think I did. I just read the novel, and then it came out around the same time, so I was kind of excited. At least it was on my radar, and I was like, oh, it's the guy that did Traffic and Ocean's 11. And then I was just – it went in a completely different direction from where I thought it would
with
go.
The input of James Cameron also as a producer.
I haven't seen Solaris, but I know that's one that a lot of people don't like. And for me, yeah, like everyone loves The Informant, but I didn't.
Oh, I think The Informant is great. It didn't.
I haven't seen it since it came out, but I need to see it again. But I wasn't thrilled with it. And I will say, like, for all of like the great things that Soderbergh does, sometimes he goes a little far. Like The Good German, which was basically
that did not work for me. It's a good.
Hey, let me make a classic Hollywood film. How does that work nowadays? Oh, not good. All right, never
mind. It's not that I don't think it's not a bad. The thing with The Good German is I like the idea of it, but the execution doesn't work. For The Informant, yeah. I will say I liked it a lot when I saw it in theaters. It didn't hold up quite as well in a second viewing, but Damon is phenomenal in it, and the Marvin Hamlisch score is a great touch. But
it's great performances out of all, even like his movies that aren't great. I feel like he gets really, really good performances out of.
Well, I was with the Limey earlier today, and I was listening to the commentary track, and he mentioned how the more his career has gone on, he tries to use more natural lighting and basically give his actors room to perform rather than constricting them to make sure that they hit their marks and move in the way that he wants them to. He wants to give them the room and the freedom to give a good performance, and clearly he gets that from them.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think Side Effects he used mostly, if not all, natural light. That's another thing that was interesting. I rewatched Traffic this weekend because I hadn't seen it in a long time, and I loved it. But I also saw Out of Sight recently too, and I think if you look at Side Effects, Magic Mike, Haywire, Contagion, the camera style, it looks like it's developed. I don't know if it's changed, but it's very, very static in these recent movies, and it's very kind of like controlled shots. But his earlier movies, there's a lot more handheld, and like, you know, Traffic, he did the whole kind of like color process to delineate the three stories, and I thought that was interesting. But I don't know, that was just something I found interesting in looking at his earlier work and his later work.
Well, one of the things I wanted to quickly go back to Solaris, just briefly touch on it, because I agree that film doesn't really work, but my favorite joke about it is that cut to Solaris. That film, just any time, just randomly cut to Solaris and then back to do something else. But again, I mean, in all fairness, that's him playing by his own rules, where perhaps another person who didn't really have any respect for the book or the original film would have just been like, I'm going to make a sci-fi film, and then just call it a day. Like, they would have done it a lot more straight, and Soderbergh wanted to keep doing it in his way. He always wants to bring that sort of at least indie flavor, if that makes any sense. He gets these big casts now. Everyone would want to work with him, and even then, he still plays it his way. I think Aaron Brockovich really is one of the outliers of his career. It's the very safe film, very reliant on a star. It gets great performances out of it, no doubt, but even then, it's very devoid of the personality. And again, it feels like it's just yielding to give Julia Roberts a good performance, which she gets, absolutely, but it's not really one of his films. But again, at the same time, I never feel that Soderbergh is overbearing, and maybe you guys disagree. I know that I'm seeing a Soderbergh film, even though that's difficult to describe, where there's other directors, and not to say that's a bad thing. I know when I'm seeing a Guillermo del Toro film. There's no mistaking it. But I love it. I love Guillermo del Toro films. But with Soderbergh, it's a bit harder to describe. Again, there's the sort of nonlinear storytelling, 60s European influence, but from there, he really kind of plays it his own way. I didn't know The Informant was a comedy until, like, the trailer came out.
Right. I can tell from the exclamation point in the title.
I didn't know there was an exclamation point in the title. For a long time, I didn't know there was an exclamation point in the title. That's what surprised me. And then when I saw it all come together, I'm like, wow, this is a comedy. But even then, it sort of turns on you. He does have these ways of playing with your expectations in a really fun way.
Have you seen Che?
I have not seen Che. See, that's the other thing.
I want to hear from someone who's seen Che. I know I've heard it's bad, and I know that is the movie that spurred Soderbergh to say, like, I got to be out of here in 5 years. Like, this is it. I'm done. So I'm really interested. I know Ebert loved it, but
were there hot women in it? was everyone really nice and got a lot? No, I'm just kidding. I'm joshing you, Ebert. Oh, God. Anyway.
I'm so happy he listens to our podcast.
He really does. Yeah. He's going to tweet about it.
That's nice.
Say, fuck those guys. Anyway, what I was going to say, though, is that's the other thing about his filmography, is that you can't just boil it down. Even in the terms of the one for you, one for me, when he does it for him, I mean, you would think Che would have been a much bigger film than it was.
Yeah,
it really kind of disappeared.
Yeah.
Well, because it premiered at Cannes, and it was 4 hours long, it was two parts, and I don't think it got, like, a great reception. I think that was the problem.
But that's the other thing. Like, Che Guevara is, like, such a huge figure, and you have Benicio del Toro playing, so an actor, like a respectable actor, playing this celebrated figure. You would think at least half the college students in America would go see that film. God, I roomed with a guy in my freshman year who had a fucking Che Guevara banner, and he hung that damn thing up in our common room, and I was just fucking hell. So I'm sorry, nothing against Che Guevara, but that cliche. You think that they could prey on that a little better to make Che a success. And also, that film comes off of Ocean's 13, which was more successful than Ocean's 12. That's the other thing. He keeps doing his own thing where he will have flops, but then he'll bring it back. But rarely is he going to get a film. I think Ocean's 11 is the most successful film in his career, box office.
I don't know. Was the sequel box office one?
I don't think Ocean's 12 made anywhere near as much money. It might be Ocean's 13. And now we're going to go to Box Office Mojo. Why do we have the internet. Let's just look it up.
12 made 362. 11 made 450.
So, wait, let's see.
Oh, yeah, 12 wasn't even close.
Ocean's 11 has the highest with $183 million. Mm-hmm. And Aaron Brockovich and Ocean's 12 are pretty much neck and neck at $125. Sure. I'm surprised Ocean's 13 flopped as hard as it did with a summer opening. And
I don't think it didn't flop.
It didn't flop, but I thought it would have done better than 12.
$311 million worldwide. So
I'll take it.
Yeah.
I wouldn't say that's a flop.
No, I'm sorry. I didn't say – I didn't. Flop was the wrong word. I think I thought it would have been more successful than Traffic.
I feel like people 12. I feel like people who loved Ocean's 11, those who felt burned by 12, right. Like maybe the general movie-going public was like, I don't care.
The thing, and I'm going to actually get to my Ocean's 12 point in just a moment. Looking at that box office, though, the other film of his that broke up got $113 million was Magic Mike. So that's a sleeper hit right there. In a big way. But talking about the Oceans trilogy.
Well, let me say something about Magic Mike real quick. Okay. Well, I guess we can get to it later. I just want to talk about how everything like post, I guess, Ocean's 13 or post J was kind of like a fuck you. Like, I'm going to do whatever the fuck I want. And if you like it, you like it. But I'm retiring, so I'm done.
Right.
And,
that's what his last few movies feel like.
Right. Well,
but we can get back to that later.
No, actually, I mean, that's a great point because that sort of ties into what I was going to say. Whereas I look at the Ocean's trilogy, and Ocean's 11 is so much fun. It's one of those films where it's like, oh, it's on TNT. Watch. I'll just watch it. It'll be in the background. It's just a really enjoyable film. And then I remember when I saw Ocean's 12 in theaters, it kind of threw me because it's so different. And when you look at it, it pretends like it has a heist, but it's not really. Like, the structure is different, and it has sort of an antagonist, but you don't really – it's weird. So Vincent Cassell is the Night Fox, and it's just such an erratic film. But I went back and watched it a couple months ago, and I watched it again, and the more I see it, the more I enjoy it, because it's really offbeat, and it plays by its own rules, and there are moments in Ocean's 12 that are just really out there. And I think I can spoil parts of Ocean's 12 now. I think it's all right. I think
it came out in 2012.
I think
so. It's been 10 years.
It's been 10 years. The part where they bring in Julia Roberts to play Julia Roberts.
That's the part that I can't see.
I love that because it's just so insane, and they keep building up to it. But then there are still amazing moments where it's just the little things, like when Brad Pitt realizes that Catherine Zeta-Jones has stolen his phone, and it just goes to this freeze frame of him getting like, as if he had just been punched in the face, and it just holds that shot, and then it'll cut over to something else. And I just like the little moments, or when Brad Pitt goes into they're talking at the train station, he's talking to Matt Damon, and he goes, "It's not in my nature to be mysterious, but I can't talk about it, and I can't help it," and he walks away, and Matt Damon just goes, "Ooh." I love Matt Damon in those movies, but I tend to love Matt Damon in everything. So Ocean's 12, though, it takes a lot of chances, and I don't think people really responded to it. And Ocean's 13 feels like a safer bet. And Ocean's 13 is fine. I enjoy it. But Ocean's 13 feels very much like, let's try to do Ocean's 11 again. And it's less rewarding to see it play out that way. I don't think Al Pacino is a particularly memorable villain, but then again, everything Al Pacino does reminds me of... Am I the only person that Al Pacino, like, you look at him, and it's like, that's an old, like, that's a grandmother? It's like, that, just his face, he just look like...
Yes, I think you're the
only person. I'm the only person who's like, if someone cast Al Pacino as like a Jewish, as like an Italian grandmother, I would buy him as that in a second. It's just, he's got that, oh god. But anyway, I think Al Pacino is still terrible.
Yeah, that mustache really sells it.
He doesn't have a mustache in 13. In any case, I don't care that I'm the only one. I'm just saying that I can't buy Al Pacino as anything other than Al Pacino anymore. It doesn't matter what he does. Exactly. He used to be great. But in any case, I think Al Pacino is sort of distracting in that film. But there's a lot – there are fun things as well. Like you have Matt Damon.
I think it's a good movie.
It's entertaining.
I don't enjoy
it's entertaining,
it as
but I don't think it – I wish it – after Ocean's 12, it does feel actually a bit like a letdown.
Well, I didn't watch one, to be honest with you. I didn't bother after Ocean's 12. I had no interest in seeing a third one.
I think you'd enjoy it.
Ocean's 13. Meh. Yeah.
I think you'd enjoy it. I think if judging by the films of his that you like, I think you would find. I would say this. If you can see, if you can, all the Ocean's films apparently play on TBS and TNT forever and ever.
Sure.
They are. They play back to back with The Shawshank Redemption, and. Right. If you can find Ocean's 13, if it's just like playing on TV one day and it's like a rainy afternoon, watch it. I think you'd enjoy it.
Yeah,
that's
honestly,
my
I'd
growing
rather
recommendation
see, like,
of Ocean's Magic 13.
Mike first, those would be higher on my list.
Of Haywire. Oh, absolutely. No, if you want to see like great films from him, and Adam, that's what you're saying. Sort of, he's like, "Fuck you, I'm going to do what I want to do," and you get Magic Mike and Haywire.
Yeah.
Out of that.
And Contagion.
And Contagion.
I mean, I would say Contagion, too.
And Contagion.
But going back to Ocean 12 real quick, there's a – I don't know if you've heard of – there's a reading of the movie that is – that the movie is about the making of a sequel. Like it's – have you read this?
No, I haven't read that.
I think it was on CriticWire, and it makes a lot of sense. Like it's essentially like you're coming back. We need you to come back. We want you to do a big heist again. We want you to get this money. We want you to do it the same way. And like the, it breaks down point by point, like what each character is. Like, this is the studio, this is Soderbergh. And kind of like like you said, it's a weird movie and it makes a lot more sense when I read that. And I rewatched it recently before I had read this, and I, like you, I enjoyed it a lot more this time around. But it's really fascinating to see. Like, it, I wouldn't be surprised if he, it's kind of self-referential in the fact, like, hey, you made Ocean's 11, which made a ton of money. Do that again, please, and make us a lot more money. And this is how you're going to do it. So, I think he kind of felt – I mean, I guess Ocean's 11 was 2001 and 12 was 2004. And in between that, he had Solaris, Full Frontal, and K-Street, which all did not do well.
Say,
K-Street was a TV show.
I would say
HBO.
Full Frontal I fucking hated. That's the only film of his that I think is so self-referential and up its own ass that I think it's unwatchable.
So it feels like he did Ocean's 12 almost against his own will. And he's said before, like, about his retirement. He's like, I'll retire, you know, until I run out of money and have to come back and do another Ocean's movie again. So
I was very conscious of the fact that he was
– I think he was conscious of the fact that he's doing it, you know, because like, oh, this is easy money and I'll do it, and but I'm going to do it my way. And so I think that's kind of what audiences were kind of blown back by, it because it is so different from the first one. And it also felt like that they were all just kind of hanging out and having a lot of fun together.
Well, that's all the films. All the movies are like we're hanging out and having fun. And so there you go. And
are those guys doing the Magic Mike? Are they going forward with the play? Wouldn't they turn that into a stage show too? Wasn't he part of that with Tatum?
I mean, that's part of the idea. I don't know if they've like gone through with it. Tatum is working like with his buddy right now who he did Magic Mike with, and he's like, I think he's gearing up to do a directorial debut. So,
oh, gotcha.
On that now, right. But they want to, and Soderbergh said he'd do the musical in a heartbeat. So.
Right. Well, that would, and I would also follow his idea of I want to do artistic projects outside.
Yeah,
of
something different. So. He wants to paint and direct plays, I guess.
Whatever he wants to do. I mean, I think
great.
I think
re-energize that creative juice, man.
Well, I think the other thing, you know, moving into his sort of quote-unquote retirement, because I don't think any of us believe that he is retiring for good. I think it's more that I personally believe he's going on an extended hiatus, that he'll be back maybe 5 to 7 years from now, because it's just unusual for directors to hang it up when they're still at the top of their game. I don't think Side Effect – I have problems with Side Effects. But mm-hmm. Magic Mike, Haywire, Contagion – Soderbergh is not a director who is washed up. He's not someone who's in director's jail. He could still make his movie. In fact, he's making about the rate of 2 movies a year. Nothing is really, really slowing him down at this point, but he is choosing to go do something else. And I can't think of another filmmaker who has sort of – when they've just sort of quit. I can think of filmmakers who have been very selective and have taken a while between projects, but none who have just said, I'm retiring. I can think of actors who have said, I'm retiring.
Yeah.
But not mm-hmm. director.
But that's not Soderbergh. He banged out Contagion, Haywire, and Magic Mike, and like I think in he filmed weekend. All three of those. Yeah, in like a span of like a year and a half or 2 years, he was just like done. And Magic Mike was hatched on the set of Haywire. He was like, "Yeah, write it. I'll do it. Let's do it in like 5 months." He's like, "Go write that."
I also love that he made those films that quickly, and yet they are great. Whereas Clint Eastwood's like, "I'm gonna make." And film every year, and I'm only going to do things in one take, and it'll come in on time and under budget, and they'll all be shit. He hasn't made a good film since Unforgiven. He really hasn't.
I liked Million Dollar Baby. I know
Million Dollar Baby, I really liked it, and then I look back on it like, what the fuck was I thinking? The film of his that I like is a film that I like ironically, which is Gran Torino. Just watching Clint Eastwood be grumpy and racist.
Be so racist.
For 2 hours. That film is a great comedy. It's not intended to be a comedy, but it's fucking hilarious. I own Gran Torino for laughs.
I'll tell you what, people here in Oklahoma love that
movie. I bet they do.
Yes, you do.
Anything that the people of Oklahoma love, I'm sure that's wrong.
Yeah.
And I have family in Oklahoma, and I love them, but that state is so fucking stupid. Goodbye, listener in Oklahoma. Sorry.
That's me.
Yeah, it is.
That's just Adam.
We eventually will alienate every listener we have in all 50 states. We're coming for you, Wyoming.
I think we already did that with
our territories.
Didn't we already do that with what?
With our Dark Knight Rises takedown.
Oh, yeah, I think that was a general thing, but we didn't insult anyone's state. Well, dude, I'm
just insulting that movie insulted every single
It really one. Did, but seriously, fuck The Dark Knight Rises. That should just be our running joke. Fuck The Dark Knight Rises. But seriously, I do get angry at that movie. No, I don't. Okay, what were we talking about? Oh, right, Steven Soderbergh. What if
Do you want to talk about Side Effects now?
Well, just real briefly, one more thing. The only franchise film that he ever did was the Oceans trilogy. He never got wooed in by like, hey, so like
Contagion 2.
Oh god, still sick. No, but like, no, the notion of like, hey, Soderbergh, want to direct a comic book movie or want to direct a, I mean, again, Oceans and also Oceans 11 is a remake. That's the other aspect of it.
Right.
But other than that, he really is sort of doing his own thing. And again, I really respect that he's never sort of been lured to do films that could have been box office behemoths, and he just sort of did his own thing, and sometimes you get Magic Mike, which is successful on its own merits.
Well, Steve asked him if he was ever interested in comedy.
Of course he did.
He said that was never his thing. He said that he couldn't do it because that's not like his world. He would feel like fake if he was doing it. And I guess he's friends with the Russo brothers, Joe and Anthony Russo, who are directing Captain America 2. And they called him up and said, hey, will you kind of vouch for us? Will you give a call to Marvel and kind of say? And he said, well, why do you want to direct this? And they said, because we've spent like hundreds of thousands of dollars on comic books and we have a huge collection and we're obsessed with it. And he said, okay, I was just making sure that you were doing it for the right reasons.
Yeah.
So like I respect that he was like, you know, like, no, I'm not going to do a comic book movie because that's not my, like, I never had a passion for it and I would feel false doing that. So
what they didn't mention,
he could have
though,
fallen into
they
like a pitfall of doing a bunch of heist movies and stuff too. He could have, I'm sure he was offered a ton of them, but it seems he wanted to differentiate
Tower
and
heist.
Not get pigeonholed as that.
I would watch Steven Soderbergh's Tower world. Heist. That's the thing though. If he attached his name to these kind of things, I would give it a shot. Because here's the thing. I learned, and it took me a long time, with Soderbergh, you have to give him that shot. Because when I first heard about Magic Mike, I'm like, there's no way in hell I'm seeing this film. So you have Channing Tatum, who hadn't proven himself yet, and he had just, I'd seen like 7 films with him and never liked him once. And then it's like, okay, in a film about male stripping, now you've cast Alex fucking Pettifer, and why do I want anything to do with this movie? And the movie's really good, so shows what I know. I know nothing. Let's talk about Side Effects and how I didn't like it.
Let's talk about how Matt knows nothing.
I think we can just defer to the comment section on that.
Yeah, you guys got that taken care of.
I like how on Twitter the other day someone brought up your editorial on why Joss Whedon is the wrong person to direct the Avengers.
That was Patches. That was fucking Matt Patches, who I'm so nice to. I think he was just ribbing me. But Russ Fisher sort of stepped in. It was a fake joking thing. But the point is that we all get it wrong from time to time about who would be a good choice and a bad choice to do something. And I've admitted on several occasions, and I'll admit it again, I was so fucking wrong about Joss Whedon. But if you went back to where I was looking from, I don't think that was an unfair assumption. I think I made my point then. But again, I was wrong. I say it now. I say it forever. Anyway, side effects. I'll describe this one.
Good luck.
Good luck. Okay, so side effects begins. It's ostensibly a thriller, but the first half is very kind of more of a think piece. The film starts off where Rooney Mara plays this woman, and her husband, played by Channing Tatum, has just gotten out of prison. He was doing a 4-year stint for insider trading, but she's really depressed, even though he's back home. She can't sleep. She looks like she's attempting to commit suicide a couple times, so she gets put into the care of a doctor played by Jude Law. And he starts recommending some prescriptions. One he recommends is called Ablixa, that comes sort of at the recommendation of her former psychiatrist, played by Catherine Zeta-Jones. And then those side effects yield horrible results. There is Ablixa may cause horrible sleepwalking, beyond not the fun sleepwalking of Step Brothers, let's put it that way. Although I wish it was. That would have been a very entertaining film. I would say the first half of Side Effects is really more of an examination of, I don't want to say an over-medicated culture, but a perhaps scattershot medication, where you have flawed individuals recommending powerful medication to flawed individuals. And it's not that there's enough blame to go around, although I would certainly say that there's a sharp kick to pharmaceutical companies who push their product aggressively over the mental well-being of the patient, where it's more important to sell a product. And really, you don't get that from any kind of other medical thing. No one tells you, like, this brand of antibiotics will be much better. It's because of these proprietary drugs, and then they sort of hook in these psychiatrists to push them, and it's very shady. But with the Jude Law character, you see that he's not a bad guy. That's the whole thing. You see that he's more of a typical guy, and perhaps that's even worse, but he's not like a villain, or he's like, ha ha ha, time to recommend bad drugs. It's nothing like that. It isn't. And so in that first half, you get a really interesting idea of a medical industry, and also this notion of what do drugs do to us? How do they change our personalities? And who are we really when we interact with these drugs? What is our true self? And then there's exploration of depression, and it's really fascinating. As a thriller, it's not that engaging. It's not I wouldn't say it's a gripping film in that sense. I think it's really intellectually stimulating. And then it seems like the screenwriter Scott Z. Burns, who, as we mentioned earlier, wrote Contagion, he seemed to run out of any place to take it. And he's like, oh crap, I brought up all these great ideas and I can't really tie them together. Who wants to make a paranoid thriller? Paranoid sexual thriller? Yeah. You. All right, we're going to go with this. All right, paranoid sexual thriller time. And it goes horribly awry. The second half of Side Effects, it's so stupid. As smart as the first half is as stupid as the second half of Side Effects. That it gets mine. And it gets infuriating because it undermines all the strong stuff from the first half. It's not just like, oh, this is a bad direction. This is a bad direction that weakens all the great stuff. So it becomes more infuriating. And I don't want to go into details about why it gets that way. I still think it's a film worth seeing, and I don't want to spoil it, but I will say the second half is really annoying. What did you guys think?
I haven't checked my watch so many times while watching a movie in I can't remember how long. It was tedious.
See more movies.
Tedious for me. Painfully tedious. I almost walked out. If we didn't have to like review the whole thing, and if I didn't want to see what happened at the end,
did you not see?
I would have walked out. What's up?
Did you not see Identity Thief? because that will have you checking your watch. That'll just have you putting the watch in front of your face and never lowering your wrist. But so you found all of Side Effects tedious, like the first and the second half?
Yeah, pretty much. The first half was sort of like, it was really bitter and very, like I said, it was like watching a dramatic reenactment on like a Lifetime show. That's what it was. Like I just pictured Channing Tatum. I was waiting for commercials to pop up because that's what it felt like. It was like, here's a true crime, true life story and dramatic reenactment on Lifetime, the channel for women. It was just,
that's
there was
sexist, Dave. No, I'm kidding. Spike TV is the
channel
same
for
way.
Yeah, I could not stand it. It was sort of like, okay, so there's one scene where a person is in a car accident, and they wake up and they're still perfectly, you know, made up, and their hair's a little tussled, and they have a little brush burn on like a cheek. I don't know. It was just there were so many things that it was like they were trying to portray it as something real and something heavy and something with gravity, but there was this sort of veil that was over it that prevented me from actually believing it, and that's what made it feel like a low budget reenactment.
To be fair, that car accident was very minor. She was not going fast, and she was not going very far.
That was a very minor car accident.
It was a casual car accident.
I mean, airbag go off and smash your face in, you're going to have more than a little brush burn on your cheek. But anyway. And then there was something else about it that just – I don't like that – this was just for the style of movie, not Soderbergh's direction or the script or anything like that. If I want to hear a story about people that are depressed and having issues with medication, I'll talk to some of my friends. You know, I'll talk to family members. I'll watch a documentary or something. I don't want to see that in a film. So, like, this isn't one of those films that I would have – I wouldn't seek it out if we weren't reviewing it today. So I just – the whole thing – and then the second part, like Matt said, just kind of falls apart. It's like they painted themselves into a corner. Didn't know how to get out of it. And they're like, we got some hot people around. Let's make it a sexual thriller. That sounds good.
Adam, what about you? What did you think?
I liked it more than you two, but I had an atypical viewing experience in that some of it was spoiled for me. So about the halfway mark, I knew where it was going. So I was kind of like twiddling my thumbs, waiting for the other shoe to drop. I feel like he tried to make like a 1980s sexual thriller, like Fatal Attraction or Body Heat, and he didn't make a very good one. It was like, I think I would have liked it much more if it was very upfront about that fact, and if it started out as like, oh, this is going to be one of those movies. Okay, like settle in, like get your popcorn ready, like settle in for, you know, kind of over the top craziness. But like you said, that first half is very smart and very kind of introspective. And I mean, I don't enjoy hanging around depressed people, but I feel like if it has something to say, if I can learn something
about
it.
You heard it here first, depressed people. You're a total bummer. Maybe you should go kill yourself.
Well, I feel like
the collision does not condone suicide. No, all right.
I feel like if it has something like smart to say about the issue and something kind of interesting or fascinating, I feel like that's worth watching. And that's kind of what I felt like in the first half. It didn't fully deliver on some of the stuff that I was thinking I was going towards. I felt like Rooney Mara was good, mm-hmm. although I kept thinking about Kate Mara because I had just mainlined House of Cards, and I was like, those are two very good looking sisters. Jude Law is very good in this, I really feel like Soderbergh had two different ideas. I'm interested to see what kind of script Scott Z. Burns wrote, because I feel like it would be schizophrenic of him to write these two different like genres in one
script.
Maybe
that's what that's what he was trying to do. Maybe he changed his medication up halfway through writing the script and got happy and zany and wrote something completely different.
I actually thought about that the structure of it is sort of meant to create this elucidation and it just doesn't really play out. Like I would say like Jude Law's character gets a little more insane as things start falling apart, but he doesn't resort to medication. It's tough to say. See, that's the thing. With the second half, everyone becomes
muddled. He does, though, at one point.
Oh, he does at one point.
Yeah, there's a scene where he does
it. Oh, yeah. So, but it still gets a little like – it starts to feel like a film where it doesn't really know what it's going for anymore. Like,
exactly.
Like it'll drop a reference to Darkness Visible, which is sort of a famous book about – a memoir about the author dealing with depression, and it's been around for decades. Mm-hmm. And it references that book, but to what end? That's the issue. And so I would say ultimately that the film's sort of a slap in the face of depressed people. Like it sort of It creates,
it's sort of like get your shit together and stop using all these medications as an excuse.
I wouldn't necessarily say that, but more the sense.
It's kind
of
like
it's a little bit like that, but more what I would say is that it's reflective of like, oh, we're too quick to prescribe medication rather than work harder to do the investigation. And if we did the investigation, we'd come up with some really interesting answers. And I'm like saying, like, if that's your investigation, that is bullshit. Because that's the thing. In the second half, Jude Law goes from being a shrink to like the super detective. He's like, if you'll notice here, he's like, and I'm going to plant a trick here. And I'm like, oh, I'm looking at this. I'm going to play all the angles. And it's like, what the
fuck? And I'm going to wire this person up. Yeah. And that's like the slap in the face, I think. Because it's like they set up some, like Adam's point, they set up some decent things. They could have asked some tough questions about sort of the pharmacological state of this country and how. There's a sideline here that we haven't mentioned about insider trading, too, that plays in an interesting way. So there's a lot of sort of the evils of capitalism in American society. They could have asked those questions, but they completely wipe out all that foundation with the second act. And I think that's more of a slap in the face to people with actual medical conditions than anything else in this film.
Yeah, it feels like the whole movie is designed to pull the rug out from under you like multiple times and be like, aha, gotcha. Like, see how fun this is? But it's not.
Because it makes no
sense.
It's not.
Yeah, it even kind of feels like if we're looking at Soderbergh's past filmography, it just, you know, Contagion, Haywire, Magic Mike are all like on paper very kind of like mainstream blockbuster plots, but he combines them or whatever with kind of his vision and his voice and makes them interesting. And it feels like on Side Effects that didn't work.
Right. But
he tried to do the same thing and it didn't coalesce. It didn't come together.
Right. Well,
of itself, three movies in a row that do that are so like great and entertaining is a feat. Like, that's kind of crazy. So I guess we could have seen this coming, but.
But it still has his sort of trademarks. It's not a 60s style, but Adams, as you were saying, it's more of an 80s kind of bleary feel. But again, there's the nonlinear storytelling as certain reveals are made in the second half. Oh, boy. But it's still not even in terms of nonlinear. I mean, in terms of, yes, chronologically it's proceeding, but Soderbergh likes to cut forward a lot, where he won't simply let a scene flow as we normally expect. It's things get choppy. That's what he likes to do in sort of keeping the audience a little off balance. And
we'll say I'm really looking forward to Behind the Candelabra, though, because that just looks like a lot of fun. Just like, you know, like crazy wigs. I've heard Rob Lowe like looks like someone who he's apparently supposed to have like a ton of plastic surgery and is just like way over the top. I think it's going to be fun.
It could be. Maybe it'll be more like the Informant, sort of that.
Yeah, I get the feeling that it's not like a straight biopic. I feel like when he's talked about it in interviews, he said it was a lot of fun.
Right.
So I think it's supposed to be a fun movie.
Well, that's the other thing. What is a straight Soderbergh film? And I don't think that exists.
I meant straight biopic.
Well, no, but again, straight biopic. Is Side Effects a straight thriller? Is Magic Mike, is like Haywire a straight action film? Is Contagion a straight disaster movie? I think he's going to put his spin on whatever he does. And so as a biopic, I agree. I'm equally interested to see what Behind the Candelabra will bring us in June. So that's when it premieres, right? June on HBO, I think.
I think so.
All right. Cool. Well, unless you guys have anything else to say about Side Effects, maybe we do recommendations?
Sure.
Okay.
Sure.
No, I mean, unless it seems like Side Effects, that's the other thing that's kind of disappointing. It's kind of cut and dried, whereas Magic Mike and Haywire, I think, have interesting things to say about gender roles that those films kind of go together really well. Side Effects, again, it brings up a lot of interesting things in the first half, but there's no payoff. So
right.
I don't know where we can really go with it. I'm fine moving on to recommendations. If you guys
totally
have something else to say. Okay.
Nope, we're good.
Talking about drugs, Dave, what do you got for us?
Yeah, I was going to go with Contagion, and then I started thinking about it and remembered how much I did not enjoy it. So we're just going to talk about drugs today. It's going to be awesome. We're going to go with Darren Aronofsky's 2000 picture, Requiem for a Dream, which if you haven't done drugs, I feel like you can just watch this movie and you will both enjoy them and be scared off of them for the rest of your life. So listen up, kids. Don't do drugs. Just watch Requiem for a Dream. Darren Aronofsky film that stars Ellen Burstyn, Jared Leto, Jennifer Connelly, and Marlon Wayans. And those are your four sort of central characters that all have some drug use or addiction or some sort of tie-in to the world of drugs that go horribly awry for everybody involved. There are literally no winners at the end of the day for this one. Where Side Effect sort of asks...
Because winners don't do drugs.
Winners don't do drugs. Unless you're... never mind, I don't want to spoil that. I don't want to spoil... what the hell's his name? Little John? Can't think of the guy's name.
Doesn't matter. Go on with... You just reminded me of, like, the, you know, the video games where it's like, winners don't do drugs, play Street Fighter 2. Go on.
Oh, Keith David. Keith David is who I'm thinking of. He might be the only actual winner in here, but for very nefarious purposes.
Oh, goodness.
Horrendous. So this, if you are depressed, I want to put this out there too. If you are depressed, please don't ever watch this movie unless you have people standing by that are going to take care of you. Because it is not a feel-good movie whatsoever. It's kind of a rainy day movie if you're already feeling like the worst possible depression on earth.
I don't know what kind of, to me it really is like put it in every classroom. And then because really all the other anti-drug films out there are too tame. Just give him Requiem for a Dream and then put it with Darren Aronofsky's meth commercials that he did. Jesus Christ.
Interrupt the acts with those meth commercials. Like, oh, let's take a breather from injecting heroin into this rotting track mark for a second and you can watch the meth commercials instead.
Right.
Yeah. I mean, honestly, just check it out as far as from an artistic standpoint. It's gorgeous. I love the camera work in this film. The music is completely insane, and it just builds and builds and builds. And watching each of these characters just kind of fall apart in their own particular way. There's also some I don't want to say lighter moments, but there's some hopeful moments that are early in the film where you think that there's a chance that these guys can kind of turn things around and get on the straight and narrow. That never, ever happens. So if you haven't seen it, do yourself a favor and definitely check it out, Requiem for a Dream.
I would also say that the score, in addition to being great, is the main theme. It was Clint Mansell did the score, and the main theme was used in trailers in half of all trailers for the next 3 years.
That's going to be the new Cloud Atlas.
That is?
Cloud Atlas is going to be used. I mean, I have a feeling that score is going to be used in a bunch. I've heard it in a couple already.
Interesting.
I think it's going to be used in a bunch.
That
of
or that Meneer song.
What?
That Lumineer song will be used in the other half of all trailers.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Adam, what do you got for us?
I am recommending my favorite Soderbergh, his 1998 crime movie, Out of Sight. This came off the string of disappointments that Soderbergh had after his debut of Sex, Lies, and Videotape, and it launched his career again and also revitalized George Clooney's career. He was coming off of Batman and Robin and some kind of
Peacemaker,
lesser movies.
One Fine Day.
Yeah, the Peacemaker, One Fine Day, and this got people to see him as like a real actor who could do things. And this, for me, is stand it next to Ocean's 11 as Soderbergh's most fun movie. This movie is just so much fun, and it's so well done. It's based on a Elmore Leonard novel of the same name, who also wrote Rum Punch, which was Quentin Tarantino's Jackie Brown, which stars Michael Keaton, who played the same character in Out of Sight, which is kind of cool. It stars George Clooney. He plays a bank robber named Jack Foley, and he encounters a U.S. Marshal played by Jennifer Lopez, who can actually act in this movie. And they kind of fall for each other a little bit, but he gets away and he's on the run with his pal Buddy, played by Ving Rhames, and they're kind of planning a bit of a heist. This goes back to heist movies because they're planning a robbery together. It also stars Steve Zahn, who I forgot was so great in this, and used to be really, really funny. He makes Saving Silverman worth watching. Albert Brooks, Don Cheadle, Isaiah Washington, Viola Davis is also in this in a blink and you miss it role, and she's also in a tiny role in Traffic, which was kind of interesting. But it's got a great score, a great cast. It really is. I think this might be, for me, his most fun movie. It's just a lot of fun, great to watch, definitely seek it out. I'm sure if you haven't seen it, you've heard of it, so go see it.
Okay. I will finish up by recommending Soderbergh's 1999 film, The Limey. And this is just a fantastic sort of revenge flick, but I think it sums up how all the things of Soderbergh playing against expectations. It has that sort of 60s European style, the nonlinear storytelling. And the film revolves around Terrence Stamp playing a father who is coming to America to investigate his daughter's death. And he is looking for revenge, even though her death is ostensibly she died in a car accident. He doesn't buy it and starts hunting down the man he believes is responsible. That guy is played by Peter Fonda. And it's a great film because it goes against expectations in a lot of ways, not only the ones I just mentioned, but most of the cast is over 50. And so it's a film where people are looking back on their lives, and it has more than I think any of other Soderbergh's other films that I've seen, and so most of his mainstream works, the editing really jumps around a lot, where characters are talking over flashbacks, and it seems like no cut is longer than 10 seconds long, and we're jumping between time and space, but it really draws you in, along with Stamps' amazing performances. And one of the coolest things the film does is that it goes into it has a flashback device from 30 years earlier, where Stamps' character is looking back on his life, and what he's actually, and so the footage they used is they took from a 1967 film called Poor Cow, Ken Loach, which stars Terrence Stamp. And so it's not a sequel in any way, but they just took another movie and used it to sort of, and reappropriated it. So when he's thinking about his wife and his daughter, there's clips of him with a wife and daughter, which is just such a cool idea to go back over 30 years and take out that footage and then reapply it and make it feel fresh in a way where it's not like we have to de-age. Not that they could afford to de-age Terrence Stamp digitally, or even like just like slap, you know how it's done, where it's like, let's try to make him look younger. It's just a really cool approach, and it's that thoughtful sort of unorthodox way that Soderbergh operates. And if you see The Limey, I highly recommend just buying the DVD and then watching it. And then there is a notorious commentary track between him and the writer Lem Dobbs. And I was led to believe it's not as heated as I thought it was, but it's definitely contentious, because what you have is a writer telling the director direct to his face, I think you did this wrong. And they're arguing about the choices, where as the screenwriter, he's like, I think you cut out too much of the stuff where you're exploring the story. And Soderbergh saying, no, I wanted to focus on the Terrence Stamp character because I thought he had the most interesting story. I didn't want to keep branching out in all these directions. I wanted to strip it down to that. And I think it's a legitimate argument. I think Soderbergh is correct. I think Dobbs' version would have shown too much, would have been too much of a distraction, but you can at least see where he's coming from. And it's an entertaining way to sort of look into the process of where a screenwriter and a director interact in terms of adapting the material that turns into a good movie. And so I really like The Limey a lot. I think it flopped after when it came out, even though it came out the year after Out of Sight. But then Soderbergh picked himself back up with that Aaron Brockovich Traffic 1-2 punch. But The Limey is just a great sort of crime film that it has this twist, but it's not a plot twist. It's a thematic twist that really hits you. And so I would strongly recommend checking out 1998's The Limey. Okay, thanks for listening, everyone. I don't know what we'll be talking about next week. I never come into this thing prepared.
What kind Die Hard
you
or wanna, Beautiful
wanna Creatures?
You
want to
go on a rundown? Yeah,
you don't want to see Escape from Planet Earth?
Oh, yeah, that's what's going on. Actually, if this were a different kind of show, I would almost want to do talk about Safe Haven and then do a Nicholas Sparks retrospective, and we'll just say they're all the same fucking movie. We should probably talk about Die Hard, but I'm also be doing a retrospective on the site this week, looking at the previous four films. And so we'll figure out what to talk about. It's always discussion worthy. Maybe J.J. Abrams will direct a new Indiana Jones movie. How about that? How about that, fuckers?
How about Predator or Aliens? Or
a remake of Raiders of the Lost Ark.
No! Watch it. It's going to happen. We predicted things on this show before. Okay, yeah. If you want to keep up with this podcast, you can follow us on Twitter. My Twitter handle is Matt Goldberg. Adam, where can we find you on Twitter?
At Adam Chip.
And Dave?
At Dr. Claw, MD.
All right, thanks for listening, everyone, and we'll be back with you next week.